At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Okay, folks, welcome to the latest chapter, the latest edition, the latest great episode of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, I have some amazing news for the audience of millions around the world who listen to Planet Porky and who like to know what's going on. And that is that a certain parcel dropped through my letterbox just days ago, a padded envelope. I thought, what's this? It's got to be a book. And feverishly, I tore it open. And there it was, your latest, greatest book. It's not on sale yet, Leslie Ann, but tell me why I was one of the chosen few who got an early copy.
Ah, this is what they call a review copy. Ah. This is the Stone Age, 60 Years of the Rolling Stones,
yep.
Which is my new book, you're quite right. It comes out on the 9th of June. Mm. So the review copies are dispatched ahead of time, obviously, to allow people to have a chance to read
yep.
it. Because it takes quite a long time to wade through a book of this size, doesn't it?
Well, you say that, and yet one reviewer clearly loved it so much, I think it was a he, got stuck into it, and I saw him put out a tweet saying, I started reading Leslie Ann's book, The Stone Age, I'm 100 pages in and can't put it down. That's a pretty positive result, isn't it?
Well, let's hope all the reviews are like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's hope your review will be like that.
It'll be positive, believe me, because, of course, like you, I'm a child of the 60s and Stones next to the Beatles, probably the most influential bunch of musicians. And, of course, you're not the only one who at the moment is focusing and celebrating on the longevity of the Stones. Don't know whether you saw the Sunday Times Culture magazine, but Mick Jagger, Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood on the cover there. There's only, how many of the originals are left now? Just two, is it? Jagger and Richards?
There's Mick and Keith, I suppose. Yeah, that's kind of the core,
yes,
isn't
yes.
it? Poor Charlie, we lost him.
Yep.
Brian Jones obviously died back in 1969.
Yeah.
So and Bill Wyman left, of course,
yes.
in the 90s.
Yes.
So, I was very keen to get the original lineup, a photograph of the original lineup for the cover
yes.
photograph,
yes.
which the publishers achieved. It's a very interesting picture if you have a look
yeah,
at it.
Yeah, I see.
It.
They're on a set of stairs or steps or whatever.
Yeah, that's in Paris leading up to the Sacré-Cœur, the Basilica, you know, at the top of Paris.
Yep.
You look down on the whole city.
Yep.
But the interesting thing about that photograph for me is that none of the Stones, except Mick Jagger, is looking to camera. He's the only one engaging with the photographer. The rest of them are looking elsewhere.
Why is that?
No idea. But it's an interesting picture because
yeah.
of that.
Well, I've got it here, actually. I'm looking at it. Oh, you're absolutely right. I hadn't noticed that, but you're right. Yeah.
He's the one who's focused on, intent on world domination, let's say.
Yeah.
And the others are kind of casually looking elsewhere.
Yeah.
It's quite symbolic.
Yeah. I think it's very symbolic. But Mick Jagger was always the most focused one, wasn't he? I mean, at the start, the rest of them thought it was a bit of a laugh. Yeah, let's make a rock group and all that. I think Mick Jagger wanted world fame and immense wealth, and he got both. So good luck to him, because I like successful people. In the Sunday Times one, the headline is Rolling Stones interview, rock and roll wasn't designed to be done in your 70s. And that to me is the crucial issue now with the Stones. Isn't it about time they gave up? We've had this discussion before on this very programme, but it's all going to be focused on the Stones this year. They're surely not going to do a celebration tour, are they, for the 70th anniversary or something?
Well, I mean, if they're still alive, they probably will. Mm. I always have to take issue with this stance.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be doing it in their 70s.
Yes, right, yeah.
It wasn't designed to be done in their 70s. Who says?
Mm.
You know, who actually made the rules?
Yeah.
I think the thing about rock and roll is that there are no rules.
Yeah.
and that whatever they decide to do goes. If you think about the top rock bands throughout history, they've all differed so dramatically from each other, haven't they?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And they've gone their own way. And that is the point of rock and roll. It's about individuality. If Jagger and Richards are still alive in 10 years' time, I'm sure people will want to see them even more.
Well, you mean because they'll then be so archaic? It'll be like, you know, watching somebody from a generation which has all but died off. Well, I suppose you could be right.
I don't know. It's that. Yeah. I think, I mean, they are an anachronism now because they're all pushing, they're actually pushing 80.
Yes, that's right.
They're already in their 70s. Yeah. They're, as far as Keith Richards is concerned, he's living on borrowed time. He must have at least 19 lives, if not 9.
I totally agree.
He's come close to the edge and losing his life so many times, and yet he still carries on. Yeah. I think they gave up the hard stuff years ago, and for them, happily, it hasn't turned out to be shutting the stable door after the horse has bolted.
Yeah, although you never...
You know, they've managed to stay upright and keep going on.
Mick Jagger's always had a very clean living life, in my view. I mean, apart from a few tablets, a few pills he got locked up for when he was with Marianne Faithfull, he's never really been caught out, has he, in the way lots of the others have. Now then, Miss Jones, what does this remind you of? Ding, 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 ding. Ding, 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 ding. Talking about music, that is, of course, the opening bars of the theme tune to Chariots of Fire, the film that was made by, who made that? The British producer or director.
I can't remember,
actually. Yeah, I can remember. I can't see him now. But I think also, wasn't it the first great film in which somebody like Jeremy Irons starred or something?
Yeah, probably. I mean, it's a long time ago. It's early 1980s, I think,
film. It is. Anyway, the reason we're talking about it is because the guy who wrote that iconic music, and I don't think he ever wrote anything else, or if he did, I haven't heard it, was a guy...
Oh, dear. Did you never see Blade Runner?
Blade Runner.
The following year?
No, never saw Blade Runner.
Yeah, best original score. He won the Oscar for that.
Really? Well, hang on. We better take the audience who we're talking about. We're talking about Vangelis, the musician who won an Oscar for Chariots of Fire, so he must have won two then, and was acclaimed for his Blade Runner score. So this bit I've got on him here, it says he won his Oscar for Chariots of Fire, but Blade Runner was just a acknowledged, acclaimed and brilliant score.
Yeah, I mean, a brilliant musician. He was one of these kind of classic all-rounders, you know, multi-instrumentalist, a composer, a musician himself. Mm. He developed this synth style of music that was very much of its time. A lot of people consider it to be passé nowadays.
Yeah.
But also many, many fans who weren't necessarily into his film music would have known him because of his partnership with John Anderson, who was the lead singer with Yes.
Yeah. Oh,
and they did several albums together as John and Vangelis.
Oh, did they? Really?
Yeah.
I'm just looking at this piece on him here. He had a group called Aphrodite's Child in 1968. I've never heard of that either. But anyway, look.
Well, he was born in Greece, wasn't he? Yeah. His actual name was Evangelos Odysseus Papathanasio.
Oh, really?
And Vangelis was his nickname.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a bit of a mouthful, that one. It's no wonder he changed his name, same as George Michael did, didn't he? George Michael had a Greek name, didn't he? But it was too much of a mouthful as well.
His first name was Yorgios, but George is the anglicised version of Yorgos. Mm. So, yeah. But, I mean, look, people call you Mike instead of Michael, don't
that's
they?
Right.
It's the same kind of thing, really.
Yeah. No, sure. Well, you know, now we know all about names. That's what you get here on Bonnet Corky. That's fantastic. But I understand you had a bit of a memorial service for Mr. Vangelis when the news came of his untimely death at the age of 79.
I just got round to some friends who I was staying with the other night. We were planning a nice dinner, just a few of us, and the news came on my mobile phone just as I was drawing up to their house outside in the car. So I bounced in the house and said, oh, no, Vangelis has died.
Yeah.
And my friend's husband just went straight to his little setup and pulled up a whole load of Vangelis music. And we toasted him with a good few glasses of wine and sat and enjoyed his music.
Excellent. That's great. I saw the a terrific clip of him actually playing, you know, the electric organ or whatever, as he's watching the opening of the film, you know what I mean? And he must be such a genius to be able to intertwine the music into the movement of the guys who were running along the beach, because Chariots of Fire was all about athletes, wasn't it? Winning gold medals and all that kind of stuff.
Yes, and I tell you who is the modern kind of incarnation of Vangelis, if you like, is Hans Zimmer.
Hans Zimmer.
Who, of course, is
Did he
just,
get the frame?
No.
Oh, really?
No, he's a German musician.
No. Oh, who is it? Who does he play with then?
Yeah, no. Hans Zimmer has composed for, look him up, I mean, everything.
Yeah.
And he's very current. I used to know him very well back in the day. We used to go to Legends together. Do you remember Legends, the nightclub off Regent Street?
I don't, Miss Jones, but, you know, my misspent youth wasn't spent in nightclubs. It was spent in bars, of course. You were mixing with the hoi polloi in nightclubs. Legend, I suppose, speaks for itself.
Legends, we used to call it.
Yeah, speaks for itself.
Legends.
Yeah.
But Vangelis was an unusual person because back in the day, 80s, yeah, when we were bouncing around interviewing all these musicians, and he never gave interviews or hardly ever at all.
Right.
And he lived a very quiet, private life. Yeah. But a few people who met him said what a nice guy he was. He was also a painter and he held a few exhibitions of his works. But you'd have to say an all-round philosophical ancient Greek, and I love people like that.
Right. Well, old Boris likes ancient Greek, doesn't he? I think he read ancient Greek and Latin at Oxford University when he got a degree in classics. So Vangelis and him have clearly got something in common. Now then, Miss Jones, only once in my life did I meet Prince Charles. And it was when I was the executive editor of the Press Association, and we're in a new building, and somehow somebody managed to pull the strings and get Charles to come and open it, you know. And he walked round the floor of the newsroom and all that. Now, I read this piece here just the other day. It says, discussing the upcoming Platinum Jubilee celebrations, Dame Joanna Lumley credits the late Terry Wogan for identifying the curious effect talking to the Queen has on people. She said, it's the royal effect. You say the first thing that comes into your head and you carry the memory of your foolishness with you to the grave, okay? Now, exactly that happened to me when I spoke to Prince Charles. I just completely lost my mind, right, and started talking utter gibberish. And Charles must be used to this because I could see him looking at me, you know, with a sort of puzzle in his eye, look, you know, trying to make out he was very interested in what I was talking to him about. But, of course, couldn't understand a word I was saying, because the problem was the new building meant all the new technology had been put in, new computers and all that kind of stuff. And for some unknown reason, I started trying to tell, you know, Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, heir to the throne, how all these computers worked. And, of course, I don't know anything about computers. You see what I mean?
Oh, big mistake.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the compensation here, of course, Joanna Lumley may well be right.
Yeah.
But you can bet your life that the Queen, Prince Charles, whoever it is, will have no memory of you at all or what you said.
Yeah, that'll all disappear after about the next 3 seconds, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Imagine the vast numbers of people they meet,
yeah,
and the vast amount of ridiculous conversations they,
yes,
have. I'm sure it all just fades into the ether and, the, you know, it's next,
yeah,
isn't it? The next day, next.
Yeah.
I'm sure all the little bouquets of flowers that these lovely children, yeah, hand to the Queen,
yeah,
just get passed on to ladies-in-waiting and the Queen never looks at them again.
Yeah, no, I'm sure you're absolutely right. The other problem was that the boss of PA, you know, the chief executive, was standing next to me. And he was even more puzzled by what I was saying than Prince Charles was, you know what I mean? But he couldn't interject then and say, why are you talking all this nonsense? Because you don't do that in front of Prince Charles. But
I don't think I'd be floored by Prince Charles. I have sat next to his wife.
Oh, yeah.
Camilla.
Which one? Camilla, yeah, yeah.
Yes, yes, I should stress that. His second wife didn't faze me at all. I was slightly bored by her, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't think Charles would have that effect on me.
Yeah.
I think it would be a lovely thing to meet Her Majesty face to face, simply because it's a historical thing, isn't it?
Oh, of course it is.
To be able to tell your grandchildren, I met the Queen.
Oh, absolutely. Opportunities.
She has been to St. Bride's Church, but I didn't meet her
on
that occasion.
I was going to say opportunities are running out now to meet the Queen, because as she becomes more frail, she's had to be more and more selective about her going out. I thought she looked fantastic last week when she went to look at the Elizabeth line. Now, this is the new Crossrail line in London. Sorry to people who live outside of London. Wish I could live outside of London, to be honest. But it's a new line which has been getting built for God knows how long, 12 years or something. And it now goes, you know, right from the far west to the far east, except it's not joined up in the middle yet. But it's called the Elizabeth line in honour of the Queen. So she went and had a look at their first trains. And I have to say, it did look very impressive. But I'm not sure we need another rail line in London.
It's what they used to call the Crossrail, isn't
it? That's right,
it? It's
absolutely.
The same thing, the controversy that was going on about all that.
Yeah.
But did you happen to watch the thing that was in Windsor a couple of Sundays ago? It was on television. The Queen turned up for this, and it was a kind of horse extravaganza.
Yes, that's right, yeah. It was the Windsor Horse Trials, I think.
Something like that, yeah. And she turned up for that, and the guy, he was a comedian, he's supposed to be famous, but I hadn't ever come across him before.
Yeah.
He was the sort of master of ceremonies of the thing. Yeah. And he turned to her at the end and he said, "May I say on behalf of everybody here, we are so grateful that you chose us over the state opening of Parliament."
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Which achieved a huge roar of approval. But you know, they said she had mobility issues, and then there started to be all these think pieces in the papers about maybe she's on her last legs, all of this. But now she's come out for Windsor. She came out for the Elizabeth line.
Yeah.
She came out for the Chelsea Flower Show yesterday to have a look round in her new buggy.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
So quite clearly, there's nothing wrong with her, apart from the fact that she's very elderly.
Yeah.
So why did she miss the state opening of Parliament?
Well, I don't know, you can't answer that. Perhaps she got up that day.
Because it's boring.
Well, yeah, no, it could be. And Charles did it in her place, and I thought he was very boring. And I commented on that and thought, you know, well, but then somebody later said to me, "No, you don't understand. You've been listening to the Queen read the opening of Parliament statement, you know, my government and all that for years. So you're used to the Queen doing it." What Charles was warned was not to put any emphasis on any particular line, because it might look then that as standing for the monarch, he was endorsing the government's policies, where, of course, you know, the royals have to be completely neutral all the time. So he just read it in a monologue so he could never be accused of favouring this or not favouring that. You know what I mean?
And he's not going to like that when he is monarch, if he does ascend.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything could happen in the meantime. But he's always been quite political, hasn't he?
Yes, he has, yeah.
And
yeah.
He has made his opinions known,
yeah, no,
and his disapproval and all that kind of thing.
I totally agree with you. I think he's going to, you know, not want to just be the reader, if you see what I mean. I think he'll want to discuss it with the head of the government, well, with the Prime Minister of the day or whatever. Now, Miss Jones, what about this ridiculous story, which you may have picked up on, but probably not because you regard it as trivia. But this young couple taking a Ukrainian refugee, okay, who is, I mean, a Ukrainian beauty. You know, you know what they're playing at. I think she's about 21 or something. And she's 22, 22-year-old Sophia Kargadin. So this young couple who've got a little child take in this lady. She's very beautiful. She's Ukrainian. And lo and behold, within 3 weeks, she's run off with the husband and they've left and set up home together, leaving the wife and child behind. And everybody's very surprised. I mean, what a ridiculous story.
Well, I did read the story. I didn't think it was a ridiculous story. I thought it was horrifying. But it's a classic cuckoo in the nest, isn't it? How dare this young woman come over here, take advantage of the hospitality of this lovely little family, and then make a play for the husband.
Yeah.
And he's defending her and saying, "Oh, we fell in love." Yeah. Well, actually, first off, were they wise to bring a beautiful young woman into their home?
Exactly.
Where, you know, men are vulnerable, men are easily tempted, I'm sorry to say. The wife is probably rueing the day that she agreed to this. Maybe there were underlying issues. There usually are when there's a young child in a family home, because bringing up a toddler is very, very difficult.
And tiring,
time-consuming and exhausting.
Yeah.
And probably the wife isn't looking her best because guess what? She's focusing on a little child. Mm. And the husband has gone off with this Ukrainian woman.
Yeah.
I think it's just disgraceful all round. I really do.
Absolutely. And the other thing is, I can see where this is all going to end, because this guy is described as a security guard, okay? Well, look, with no disrespect to security guards, security guard is right down at the bottom end of what I would call exciting professions. or, you know, professions that offer a future. They're basically, the job is to stand around in Tesco's looking bored to try and stop people shoplifting.
Yeah, and so they're not many prospects, is what you're saying.
Exactly, they're not great prospects. So am I mischievous in thinking young Sophia, this is the name of the lady who's the Ukrainian, probably wants to get a clause into any Englishman she possibly can. And this guy, by the way, has not got just got tattoos up and down his arms. He's got tattoos around his neck and up the side of his face. I mean,
he's not exactly a catch, is what you're trying
exactly
to say.
Not exactly a catch, but what I'm saying is, if this whirlwind romance, and that's exactly, you're exactly right, that's what he described it as, you know, he said, it was a whirlwind romance, I couldn't help it, and we want to build a new life together.
Oh, absolute bollocks. Yeah, sorry, but really.
Exactly. So she gets a clause into this guy. This guy's English, right? She then becomes a British citizen. And then I would say that, you know, security guard gets the old elbow because she's so good looking, she'll go off and find somebody else. Am I mischievous in thinking all that?
No, you're absolutely right. So he divorces poor wife. Yeah. He marries this one. She gets her citizenship and then she dumps him. And then he's got nothing. His poor wife and child are damaged beyond repair. Yeah. Everybody's brokenhearted and she will swan off and grab herself another one. I think it's appalling, this story. Yeah. I think it's horrible. And I think actually she ought to be deported back to Ukraine. Yes. Do not come here and break up our families.
I totally agree. It'll put a lot of other people off as well, because they'll think,
of course it will,
what's going on here, taking advantage and all that kind of stuff. Now, Miss Jones, because you have an eye on showbiz, you'll have been watching the Cannes Film Festival. It hasn't happened for a couple of years. Did you have a star at the Cannes Film Festival, Miss Jones?
I used to have to go down there for, no, it never starred at it, of course, but I used to cover it back in the day. And then after many years of not having been down there, I was freelancing for the Sunday Express, actually, when Martin Townsend was editor.
Oh, yeah.
And he sent me down there in 2009. I was the only one they sent. In the old days, newspapers would send a team of six or eight people, you know, photographers. Yeah. So you've got all bases covered.
Yes.
They sent me down there on my own to get whatever I could because I was a Cannes veteran.
Right.
Actually, I did file about five stories a day.
Excellent.
And I did get a couple of front pages and some spreads.
Fabulous.
And some news pieces. Yeah. So I feel like I acquitted myself well, given the competition and the fact that I was solo.
Yeah.
But it's a hard beat, that one.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've ever done that job, but it is a really tough beat.
I haven't done that, but I've done things like World Cups where you've got to get, you know, maybe half a dozen stories a day. I'm talking about for radio. And I'd have to get, you know, at least half a dozen stories a day, you know, interviews with fans, interviews with players if possible, just generally the overall state of the country, South Africa or Germany or wherever, Brazil or wherever it's being held, you know. And I have to say, I did really enjoy them. They were always great adventures. But like you say, it was 20 hours a day. Is that where you met our mutual friend, Mr. Tavner?
No, it's not actually. We met at the Rose d'Or festival in Montreux, in Switzerland, which started out as a television festival, you may remember.
Yes.
And it was the Golden Rose that was the award for all the various categories.
Yep.
And they used to put rock and roll music on in the conference center in the evening to entertain the delegates.
Right.
And over the years, the music element became a much bigger part of the festival than the TV was.
Right.
It doesn't happen anymore. It's finished now.
Right.
But it became the place where all bands from all over the world used to come and they were showcased and it was always televised and so on.
Yeah.
And we had some capers down there, I can tell you. But going back to Cannes, the thing about most of the journalists had to stay out of Cannes in sort of villages in the hills.
Yes.
And then you'd have to come in. So you'd have a half hour, 45 minute journey into Cannes because there are a few hotels. The hotels in Cannes are really expensive and all the stars and the entourages and the...
Yeah, they're all booked, aren't they, by the cinema?
Yeah, they are,
by the studios and all that kind of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So they would all stay in town. Yeah. So all the journalists would have to stay out of town and come in. But you have to be there for the very first screenings early in the morning or about 8:30 in the morning. Mm. So you have to, because all the red carpet stuff that happens all throughout the day and the evening, you have to be wearing evening dress.
Oh, I see.
So you have to rock up in Cannes, in the town, dressed in your finery as if you're going to an evening red carpet event.
I see.
And you have to stay like that all day, which when you're trying to work, rushing around, getting interviews and so on, is a really difficult thing to do. It's also boiling hot.
I was about to say, it's usually boiling hot as well, isn't it?
So you're sweating away. Yeah. You've got your high heels on, your long frock, your hair all kind of piled up. By the end of the day, you look like a clown.
Yeah, well, I bet you did. I used to quite like those out-of-town things that you're talking about. So, for instance, when we covered the World Cup in South Africa, we decided to occupy what they call a lodge, which is like a sort of bed and breakfast hotel type thing. There's millions of them in South Africa. But it was outside of Cape Town because for the same reasons, you know, Cape Town was full of football people and all that kind of stuff. And it's a special thing living with the same people under the same roofs for 6 weeks. It doesn't half sort of bring on tensions and problems and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? But at the same time, it's very homely, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it is. It's honour among thieves.
Yeah, that's right. That sort of thing, yeah. But there we are. And we used to do the same thing. Where did I do it? Oh, yeah, in Germany and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, there we are.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by shipping cheap parts around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Skip the tariff and snag yourself American-made clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
Right, okay, folks. Thank you very much indeed for being tuned in here to Life on Planet Porky with myself and Miss Jones. Just to recall what we were talking about at the start of this podcast, Miss Jones' book. Forgotten the name of it now.
The Stone Age.
Exactly. It's here right in front of me. But it's turned over the wrong way. Stone Age is soon going to be available, folks. So I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward also, Miss Jones, to see your, you know, rather wonderful visage on screen as you do all the TV interviews. And by the way, even if you do radio interviews these days, your visage will be on the screen because everything now is cameraed, if you see what I mean.
Yes, exactly. Talking of which, did you see the quite incredible interview that Emma Barnett did with Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe that was on television on the BBC this week?
No, didn't know.
Unbelievable. I mean,
she the lady, by the way, who was released from Iran after...
Yes, she lost 6 years of her life in an Iranian prison on spurious spy charges.
Exactly.
Of which she was never guilty.
Exactly.
She was just there with her baby, visiting her mum and dad. Yeah. And was arrested. And she was used as a pawn, of course, in this ongoing dispute between the UK and Iran, because Iran, donkeys years ago, ordered a number of tanks from us, which were never delivered. The order was cancelled. We'd already been paid £400 million, and we never gave the money back until very recently. Yeah. And she was used disgracefully as a pawn in that.
Yeah.
And people criticised her after she was returned to the UK, for not being grateful for all that the government had done for her to get her out, and for being so angry and for being bitter and this and that. And how dare people criticise her?
Yeah.
This was a mother who was still breastfeeding her child, who was ripped out of her arms at the airport and taken off to goodness knows where. Mm. She was flung into a room, a 4x4 cell with no windows and with a light on round the clock. Mm. And she was tortured, basically. And then she was put into a centre. She did not see her husband and child for 6 years. Mm. And nothing, no amount of money, nothing that anybody can do can return those 6 years to her. It was extraordinary television. It was a radio interview for Woman's Hour,
which
Emma Barnett presents. Yeah. But because they, as you rightly say, they film everything, that was posted on television and we all got to see. And the anger in that woman is boiling.
Yeah.
And she will take a long time, if not forever, to get over what she experienced in Iran.
I feel very sorry for her, but I wouldn't have gone to Iran in the first place, honestly. You know what?
Exactly. Well, that's where her parents live. Well, she is a British Iranian.
Yes, I know, but it's still a very dangerous country to go to. Because particularly if you've got any British ties, you know there is a danger you're going to be held hostage there, particularly when that row about the payment for the tanks was still bubbling under. And I think she was foolish. Now, I know what you're saying. There's an accusation that Boris Johnson didn't help because he said in some parliamentary committee, oh, she went over there to teach journalism, didn't she? And the Iranians used that as an excuse to say, so she is a spy after all, you know what I mean? Which was awful.
She said to in response to that, that when she and her husband Richard went to see the Prime Minister at number 10, that she tried to explain to him how much damage he had done with that throwaway remark and how that added 4 years to her sentence. Yeah. And she said he just didn't get it.
No, well, look, he's got a lot of things to deal with. And, you know, I'm not making excuses. Perhaps he should have been a bit more discreet about the way he said it. But honestly, the situation of Britons abroad and trying to get them out of jails is one of the most challenging problems for the Foreign Office in this country, because we are such a civilized country. We don't anticipate that other people can be so uncivilized as to use human beings as bargaining chips in political disputes. But it happens all the time. And that's why, I mean, for instance, there are some countries I would never go to again, even if I was offered £1 million. I wouldn't go to Libya and I wouldn't go to Afghanistan. I clearly wouldn't go to North Korea, because you know there's an opportunity or a chance that you're going to get locked up. But anyway, look, enough of international politics. Back to a friend of yours. Very sorry to read that former Slade drummer Don Powell is recovering in hospital after a bowel cancer operation. I'm not sorry to read that he's recovering, but I'm a bit sorry to read that he got struck down in the first place.
Well, Don is a really good friend of mine. I'm terribly fond of Don. Yep. I've been talking to him all the way through this experience, mm-hmm. and he's been sending me pictures of himself in hospital and so on. He was really bloody lucky, I have to say, because he was having a checkup about something else. Yeah. And he's had a few health issues recently. Do you remember a couple of years ago, he got off a train. He was doing a bit of a music tour of Europe.
Yes.
And his legs just gave way under him. His legs just collapsed.
Wow.
And the bone all disintegrated.
Wow.
And he was in hospital for a long time.
Osteoporosis, or whatever they call it.
Osteoporosis.
Osteoporosis,
I think it was some form of that, but the bone just disintegrated. Mm. He was in a bad state.
Yeah.
But this time around, he was having a checkup for something else.
Yes.
And they discovered, quite by chance, mm-hmm. That he had bowel cancer. They whipped him into hospital. They performed a surgery on him the next day. Mm. He's now home, recovering, mm-hmm. and in fine fettle. Yeah. And he's due here in a couple of weeks, because we have our biannual Scribs lunch, you know, the Scribblers, Pluckers, Thumpers and Squawkers.
Yeah.
And Don is a stalwart at that mm-hmm. lunch. He never misses it. And can't wait to see him, really. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
He's a fantastic character. He lives in Denmark.
Yes.
In a place called Silkeborg.
Oh, yeah.
He met his second wife, Hannah, at a Slade gig there. And they just kind of fell in love backstage. And
she's Danish, is she?
She is, yes. She's absolutely lovely as well. And she had three children from previous marriage, so he has three stepchildren, which is lovely.
Brilliant.
He's a lovely, lovely person.
Have you ever been,
really worthwhile guy.
Have you ever been over to see him in Denmark?
No, I haven't, because he always comes here.
Right. Have you been to Denmark?
Yes.
What do you think of the Scandinavian countries?
I think that they have it exactly right.
Really?
I think they have the live work model, live life. What is it I'm trying
life
to say?
Life work.
Work life balance.
Work-life
I think
balance,
they have, yes, they have that exactly spot on. And they're also very, especially Sweden, I would say, over all of them. Finland, maybe as well.
Yeah.
They have great respect for their aging population, which, you know, we seem not to have in our country.
Yeah.
And I think we could import a few of their ideas.
I think their taxes are too high, you see, because you're absolutely right. They have great sort of social services. They look after the elderly and all that. But I don't like high taxation. I think people should spend their own money, because they spend it more efficiently than governments do. But I do love Scandinavia, because as you know, I like cold countries, okay? So I've been to wonderful Copenhagen, because I think great city. Been there to watch football, been there to, I just went there once actually on, you know, with a load of other journalists on what we might call a freebie or something. But when I,
a jolly. Yeah. You like Reykjavik as well,
don't you? Oh, I love Reykjavik. I love Iceland. I've got to get to Finland. I haven't been there. And
I'll tell you who I went there with was Eddie the Eagle.
Oh, did you? What?
Because Donkeys years ago, yeah, he had a number one hit in Finland with that song he released called Fly, Eddie, Fly.
You're joking.
And it was number one in Finland, yeah, and I flew to Finland with him to do his promo tour.
Good God. That's absolutely amazing. The reason I'm interested in Finland is because they seem to me to be a great country. I read a very political piece about them just a couple of days ago. They're now getting geared up in the expectancy that the next thing that could happen in the huge, you know, international dispute between Russia and Ukraine, well, that is the Russian invasion of democratic Ukraine, is the Russians might turn on Finland or the Baltic countries, and Finland say, we are prepared. And they've been getting prepared for years, you know, because obviously Russia, an unstable rogue state. So I like what I read there, and I thought I'm going to go and see this and offer my support from the United Kingdom.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
Well, I think you've got to, where democracy exists, people forget how precious it is, and you've got to do a lot to try and defend it and spread it around the world. It never worked, by the way, the idea that all these mad politicians like David Cameron and Tony Blair had. Oh, I know what we can do. Let's go and democratise parts of the world that don't have it. No, sorry, it doesn't work like that. Those places in the Middle East were built on very false geographical lines. They're mostly run by tribal instincts. And when you try and put tribes together and tell them they're a country, it never works.
No, that's so true. You couldn't be more right. Democracy is an organic thing. It has to grow from the ground up, and it has to infect a life slowly,
yes,
if you like.
It
has to be something that people come to terms with because they see for themselves that it's the right way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people think democracy is a waste of time. The Chinese, for instance, they just laugh when they realise it's taken 15 years now just to get the go-ahead for the third runway at Heathrow, which will take about another 5 years to even get started. Whereas in China, they build airports in 3 months because they don't have to go to any local planning committees. They just build it. And some people in the world can't see the point of democracy. I remember once talking to a British soldier who'd come back from Iraq after he'd been out there for 6 months to train other soldiers in Iraq, including the Iraqi police. And they gave them this lecture on interview techniques when you talk to somebody who you suspect of a crime and how you go through the procedure and try to determine exactly what happened and get them to admit to the crime. And one of the students in the room said, why don't you just beat the confession out of them? And he was absolutely serious. You know, they didn't understand this process of democracy or anything like that.
Or human rights.
Or human rights, absolutely right. And if you're dealing with people who have that mindset, it's never going to turn around, is it?
No, and I think people tend to forget that the opposite of democracy is a dictatorship.
It is, yeah, totally agree. But there we are, we're getting a bit too philosophical.
Aren't we just?
Yes, we certainly are. Putting the world to rights today, Miss Jones.
Indeed.
In this week, in 1956, Paul McCartney lost his mother at the age of 14. I didn't realise he was so young when she went. And of course, many years later, he wrote the song Let It Be about her, didn't he?
Yes, he did. It was so, so sad. His mother, Mary, after whom he named his second daughter.
Yeah.
She died of breast cancer. She was only 47, and she was a very worthwhile woman, yeah, Mary McCartney. She was a midwife and a nurse, and she served the local community. Mm. Everybody loved her, and she was greatly missed.
Yeah.
He was only 14. His little brother, Mike, I think, was 11.
Yeah.
And the awful thing about the 1950s, you know, family life hadn't woken up yet, if you like. There was very little communication with kids. So as he himself has said, it was never talked about.
Yeah.
We never discussed it. My dad never sat us down and talked us through it. One day she was there, the next day she was in hospital, and then she was gone.
Yeah.
And nobody ever explained anything to us. And he said he would go to bed at night and he would lie there listening to his dad sitting downstairs by himself crying. But it was never talked about. And then, of course, the compounded tragedy was that years later, in 98, I think it was, Paul's wife, Linda, also died of breast cancer, and she was only 57. So there was a symmetry there. Yeah. He had to relive the loss of his mother through the death of his wife.
Golly, that's awful, isn't it? You know, really shocking.
Yeah, it
really
is.
Shocking.
But if you think about Paul McCartney's life, he's one of the reasons why he's such a brilliant songwriter is that he's always had so much to write about.
Well, you say that, but I mean, I've had a very interesting life, and I've often lay awake at night and thought, right, instantly, compose some lyrics and ask somebody to put music to them. And you can't. I mean, my astonishment of Lennon and McCartney is that they wrote song lyrics like you and I conduct a conversation. Do you see what I mean? They came so easily to them. And that's their genius. You know, the genius of being able to put together a song in a few minutes, like, you know, the lyrics that John Lennon and Paul McCartney did. Such a genius talent when you think of the range of subjects they wrote about. Where on earth did Paul McCartney get Maxwell's Silver Hammer from?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? It's fascinating. But
but
I mean it's this ability to be able to encapsulate vast universal sentiment, emotion, feeling into a few succinct lines and particular words. And not very many people have that ability. Yes, there are a lot of songwriters out there, and there have been a lot of bands, a lot of artists. No one has ever matched the brilliance of McCartney and Lennon together.
No, I totally agree. You know, where, you know, so Paul McCartney sees a traffic warden in the street in Maida Vale or wherever he lives in London, and a few minutes later, or a few hours later, he's sitting at the piano and he's composed a song called Lovely Rita. Lovely Rita, meet a maid. May I inquire discreetly, when are you free to have some tea with me? I mean, that is sheer genius. You know, you look at a traffic warden and within hours you've written a song about it. It just blows my mind.
I mean, it's quite interesting because you will have heard them talk about the composition of Yesterday, for example.
Yes, Scrambled Eggs.
So it was, Alma Cogan's piano round her mother's flat, and they sit down. And really, he had the melody in his head, first of all.
Yeah.
So he's banging away at the piano. And he's only coming out with Scrambled Eggs, Oh Baby, I Love Your Legs, because these are just words that pop into his head.
Yeah.
He's just eaten scrambled eggs that Alma's mother has cooked for
yes.
him. And he's just coming up with words that scan to the music before he writes the proper song.
Yeah.
So they literally just come out with any words that fit the music until they come up with the theme of what they want the song to be about. So really, Lovely Rita, Meet a Maid probably wasn't what he intended to write as a song.
No.
He just had this melody and he was trying to scan some words to it with the right number of syllables.
Yeah. But then,
it's as simple as that and as hard.
But through the 60s, they never ran out of words. I mean, how do you write I Am the Walrus? And there's thousands of words in I Am the Walrus. I don't know if John Lennon remembered them all, probably hadn't written them down. Now, moving on from that, Miss Jones, you know that I've always had a huge regard for the armed forces in this country. My dad was in the Navy for 6 years during the Second World War, joined when he was 17 years of age. By the time he was 23, he'd served for 6 years and fought a war. But this story caught my eye. A Victoria Cross awarded to an RAF pilot who landed his plane despite being mortally wounded in a near-suicidal raid has sold for a world record £682,000. So that's the story. But it's the backstory here about this guy. So this guy was 24 years of age. He'd become a squadron leader, you know, at that very, very young age. He took off for a mission to attack a Japanese airbase just as enemy planes arrived to dive bomb the aerodrome in Malaya. Despite seeing all the other aircraft that were due to accompany him on the raid get destroyed on the ground and several of his colleagues get killed, he took off and carried on alone and encountered enemy planes lining up to fire at him. He used his brilliant flying skills to complete a successful bombing run on the Japanese air base in Thailand he'd been sent to destroy, but was shot several times by close-range cannon and machine gun fire from the aeroplanes attacking him. Barely conscious, he somehow kept his grip on the controls, crossed back over the Malay-Thai border, and miraculously force-landed his plane in a paddy field, allowing his two other crew members to escape without injury before the plane exploded into flames. I mean, would we get 24-year-old men to conduct acts of valour like that these days?
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? It's that reckless courage, risking all for the cause.
Yeah.
And I think they just went into it almost blind.
Yeah.
You know, this was the job. They set their own lives aside, yeah, and they just went for it in a way that I think you're right. Not very many people would do today.
No, I honestly read obituaries in all the posh papers, the Times, the Telegraph, the Guardian, and there are still Second World War heroes who, you know, happily have lived to over 100 now. But every time I read them, there's a story of outstanding courage, and it really does blow my mind. Now then, Miss Jones, since we last recorded, my team Everton are safe. We beat Crystal Palace 3-2 after going down 2-0. What a nervous night that was. I'm not joking. But the whole, you know, world of Evertonianism exploded as though we'd won the European Cup, whereas in fact all we'd done is stave off relegation. But you were talking about the 50s, okay? I was... Everton came back into the top division in August 1954. At the time, my mother was carrying me, and I was born 4 months later in December 1954. Isn't that amazing? And since that day, the Everton team that I support have never gone down from the top division. That's quite an amazing stat, isn't it?
Well, yes. And
considering I'm 67.
Yes, it's quite obviously all to do with you.
Yeah, well, absolutely. While I'm here, they're going to be in the top round. But there was rather...
You are their lucky mascot.
I am their lucky mascot. Yeah, I better stick around a bit longer. But there was a darker side to the night, actually, because the Everton fans invaded the pitch in celebration. But as usual, things got a bit out of hand. There was a skirmish between Patrick Vieira and two or three Everton fans who disgracefully were trying to taunt him as the opposition manager. And Vieira lashed out and... he was clearly frightened. There were thousands of fans on the pitch and all that, and he was trying to make his way to the dressing room. But anyway, as we are just recording this now, it's been confirmed that no action will be taken against Vieira for lashing out against the fans, which I'm happy to, to hear. But...
Well, quite bloody right. I mean, yeah, this guy was unprotected in the middle of a baying mob.
Indeed.
Anything could have happened. Yeah. Somebody could have killed him. And then they start talking about... bringing charges, yeah, against him, yeah, for having kicked a fan. This bloody fan was filming what was going on.
Yeah.
So that he could gloat all over Twitter.
Yeah.
I think the pitch invasions have to be banned.
I agree.
And made a criminal offence. They've got to be for the safety of everybody. Otherwise, yeah, we're going to get another disaster, a Hillsborough.
Well,
somebody's going to die. Lots of people are going to die, yeah, if it isn't stopped. Enough is enough.
No, your words are very strong, very right. And of course, I'm an Evertonian, and I can say on behalf of 99.9% of Evertonians, we all hated to see what we saw there with Vieira. And of course, Everton Football Club suitably shocked. And you're right, it mustn't happen again. Right. OK, Miss Jones, thank you very much indeed. And to everybody out there, thank you as well. Hope you've enjoyed the latest edition of Planet Porky. And we'll be back with you again very soon. Now, exactly that happened to me when I spoke to Prince Charles. I just completely lost my mind, right, and started talking utter gibberish. And Charles must be used to this because I could see him looking at me, you know, with a sort of puzzle in his eye, trying to make out he was very interested in what I was talking to him about. But of course, couldn't understand a word I was saying, because the problem was the new building meant all the new technology had been put in, new computers and all that kind of stuff. And for some unknown reason, I started trying to tell, you know, Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales, heir to the throne, how all these computers worked. And of course, I don't know anything about computers, you see what I mean? Everton came back into the top division in August 1954. At the time, my mother was carrying me, and I was born 4 months later in December 1954. Isn't that amazing? And since that day, the Everton team that I support have never gone down from the top division. That's quite an amazing stat, isn't it?
Well, yes. And it,
considering
it's
I'm 67. Quite obviously,
yes, it's quite obviously all to do with you.
Yeah, well, absolutely. While I'm here, they're going to be in the top round. But there was rather...
You are their lucky mascot.
I am their lucky mascot. Yeah, I better stick around a bit longer. Just to recall what we were talking about at the start of this podcast, Miss Jones' book. I've forgotten the name of it now.
The Stone
exactly,
Age.
Exactly, it's here right in front of me. But it's turned over the wrong way.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.